This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, despite being a huge part of a healthy diet, veggies are often an afterthought when we cook. A side dish, maybe, or something to add a little color to the main course. But knowing how to properly choose, store, and cook vegetables can elevate them from a sidekick to a standout success. The author of a new vegetable cookbook is here on Food Friday to break down the science of making delicious, vegetable-focused meals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are some of your favorite veggies to cook with this time of year in particular? Have you tried any new-to-you vegetables lately? Do you have any vegetable cooking hacks or recipes you want to brag about? Or is there something you want to like, or you've had it better when someone else makes it and you are trying to figure out what to do with it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nick Sharma is a molecular biologist, writer, photographer, and chef behind the award-winning food blog A Brown Table. He's the author of the new cookbook, Veg Table: Recipes, Techniques, and Plant Science for Big-Flavored, Vegetable-Focused Meals. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on your show today.
What led you to tackle a book focusing on the humble vegetable family?
Because no one else has. I really wanted to write a book about the science of vegetables, but also just make it fun and approachable so people could have big bowl flavors and spend less time in the kitchen and appreciate vegetables for what they are.
And what are vegetables? I know, you know, somebody could tell me, Rob, a cucumber is actually technically a fruit. A tomato is technically a fruit. Yeah, okay. Botanically, how are we talking about vegetables when we're talking about cooking them?
Okay, so that was really an interesting thing to bring up, because when I was writing the book, I was stumped trying to find what's the definition of a vegetable. And it turns out that in biology, most of the vegetables, like you mentioned, are usually fruits. But there is no definition of vegetables in biology, and it's more of a colloquial thing where it's based on use. So a vegetable could definitely be a fruit. It could also be a leaf, a stem, a root. It's basically how we cook it, and if we're treating it in a savory fashion, that's what makes a vegetable.
Well, the nice thing, I think if we surveyed people, we'd all pretty much agree on what's a vegetable and what's not for the most part. Did you find any arguments or pushback for people like mushrooms don't count or anything like that?
You know what? I had to leave mushrooms out of the book as a separate chapter, because mushrooms aren't really plants.
Right.
And yeah, so I definitely received a few comments from people who were like, wow, maybe you should have included avocados, for example, because we eat avocados mostly, you know, kind of in like a vegetable. But I left them out because I think of them as a fruit. So there were definitely some people who felt that certain vegetables that they were really attached to should have been in the book. And I think that was the biggest controversy that I dealt with.
Nick, my biggest problem with vegetables is I buy them and in some cases I don't use them fast enough, apart from planning ahead to use those vegetables. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, some basic advice on avoiding spoilage?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the most important things, because I feel vegetables these days, they cost a lot of money. You're taking time to go to the farmer's market or the grocery store. So it's really important you get the most bang for your buck. Now, with vegetables, if they're really wet, like, you know, especially things that are green, they photosynthesize, they produce water, wrap them up in paper and put them in the refrigerator. There are some vegetables that are better left at room temperature, like tomatoes and even cucumbers. I used to keep cucumbers in the refrigerator, but it turns out they're better stored at room temperature. Huh. And then a lot of vegetables and even fruits are better kept in the dark than they are in direct sunlight, because they start to ripen and go bad really quick. So, you know, cutting access to oxygen, keeping them at low temperatures and keeping them away from sunlight are huge, huge saving graces for them.
And you write that some vegetables don't play well with others, that they actually release a chemical that makes other kinds of vegetables go bad faster.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, coming back to the point of which vegetables are fruits, a lot of the ones that are technically fruits, like tomatoes, for example, if you keep them next to broccoli or next to kale or collards, they'll start to release this plant ripening hormone called ethylene. And ethylene will eventually make the broccoli and all these green vegetables turn yellow and go bad really quick. So keep them separate. That's really important. And this holds true for any type of fruit, like apples, pears, bananas. Keep them away from your vegetables.
It's Food Friday. Nick Sharma is with us talking about his new cookbook. It's called Vegetable Recipes, Techniques, and Plant Science for Big Flavored Vegetable-Focused Meals. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your favorite vegetables or maybe some advice you need on how to cook a particular kind of vegetable. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Nick, I want to check out one of the recipes you shared with us. We're going to get these up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Brussels sprouts. Now, Brussels sprouts in the United States, they're so much better than there used to be. And you've got, this looks great, sweet and sticky Brussels sprouts. Talk about what's making these sprouts sweet, sticky, and delicious.
Okay, so I like sweet and sour. That's one of my favorite two flavor combinations. And so these Brussels sprouts, they're roasted, and then they're kind of just tossed in a sauce made with mirin, which is a Japanese sweet wine. There's a little bit of miso to add savoriness, saltiness, and a little bit of honey, which adds sweetness. You can also use maple syrup and make this vegan. Fold it all together. It eventually just creates this beautiful umami, sweet, salty sauce that's nice and sticky. And I like eating it by itself, just with rice. It's so good.
Can you talk about roasting a little bit? You say in the book, Brussels sprouts are still best roasted. Give some basic roasting advice for sprouts and other vegetables that would do well in the oven.
Absolutely. So with any vegetable, if you're trying to roast them, my tip of the day, and this, you know, it holds universally true, is to place them on a wire rack on a baking sheet and then stick them in the oven. What happens is any liquid that's coming out from the vegetables falls to the bottom of the pan and dries off. Otherwise, everything ends up sitting in a pool of water. It also just helps the hot air in the oven flow around it much better. Another tip that I tell people is add a pinch of salt. Don't over-season it. And then also add a little bit of baking soda, maybe 1/8 of a teaspoon to a pound of Brussels sprouts. Toss them together. Just a tiny amount of baking soda will help it caramelize even faster and help develop those beautiful caramelly, nutty flavors that we love.
And speaking of caramelizing, you talk about one of the most sugar-rich vegetables out there is onions and their close relatives. I don't think of, I mean, you talk about sweet onions, I guess. Talk about the amount of sugar we have in the onion family and how we can make the most of it.
Yeah, so onions, garlic, and other members of the allium family, they contain these long, long chains, or rather polymers, of fructose. And fructose is the sugar that makes honey sweet. So now you think about that. You've got these chains of these molecules all tied together, fructose. When an onion is cooked down, the pungency goes away, and then it starts to reveal its sweet character. So, you know, when you're making onion jam, that's probably the most easy example to imagine. It tastes very sweet because you're cooking all those onions down, those polymers are breaking down, and it's releasing that sweet sugar fructose. So onions are actually one of the most sweet vegetables in the vegetable world.
You write in the book that, you know, yes, fresh vegetables are lovely and great, and they're not always, you know, seasonal when you want them. When do you reach or suggest people reach for frozen veggies or canned veggies that's going to work out just fine?
That's a really good question. So I always tell people, if you can find something, but if you know it's available frozen, go for it. Because often frozen vegetables actually are richer in nutrients because they don't spend that much time from the farm to reach the market or your grocery store. When they're frozen, they come straight off the plant, they're processed minimally and frozen, so all the nutrients are, you know, retained. For example, during Thanksgiving and during Christmas holidays, a lot of people cook sweet corn. Now, if you're cooking sweet corn, I would tell people just buy frozen because it's much sweeter in taste. The flavor is better and it holds on to its crunch. Spinach, that's a really another great vegetable. If you don't want to deal with cups and cups and bags of spinach just to make one cup of cooked spinach because it shrinks down, just buy frozen spinach because it's already shrunken down and you get more value for your money. So there are a lot of amazing frozen vegetables out there. Don't feel shy. Get it, especially if it's not in season and you're having a craving.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to molecular biologist turned author Nick Sharma. His new cookbook is Vegetable Recipes, Techniques, and Plant Science for Big Flavored Vegetable-Focused Meals. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you have a family recipe for a vegetable dish you would like to share? Is there a go-to that everybody in the family, maybe even the kids, love to eat? Is there a vegetable that everybody else hates but you like? or vice versa? Are you the only person in your family who likes beets, say like me? Join in with your favorites, your questions on how to prepare veggies for best effect at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with molecular biologist, writer, photographer, and chef Nick Sharma. His new cookbook is called Veg Table: Recipes, Techniques, and Plant Science for Big-Flavored, Vegetable-Focused Meals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been struggling with bland or soggy vegetables, or was that what vegetables looked like maybe growing up for you? Do you have trouble keeping vegetables fresh until you can use them? Is there something not turning out right in that vegetable dish? Call in with your favorites, your questions for our guest, maybe something you found that's a big hit with the kids in your family in the vegetable world, even if they're fussy eaters. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nick, do you have thoughts for that? You know, there are people, grown-ups and kids, who might say, yeah, I just generally don't like vegetables. Do you have, you know, gateway vegetables or dishes that you could help win people over with?
Absolutely. I think start with something simple like cabbages. So if, you know, kids don't like vegetables, and I was a kid that also hated vegetables, I always asked for, you know, like I wanted my steak or I wanted chicken or fish. But with vegetables, I think start with vegetables that, you know, they aren't that smelly. The textures are really comfortable. So carrots, cabbage, potatoes, peas, those are generally crowd pleasers. And once you start, you know, teaching kids to appreciate those textures, then slowly start bringing other vegetables in. I think it's always a really good idea to slide things in slowly and sneakily, and to make sure people appreciate them. And then find out what, you know, flavors they like. So if someone likes, leans more towards savory, why not cook cabbages with tomatoes or some other kind of pasta sauce maybe, you know? So there are always ways to kind of make vegetables more fun and flavorful. And make sure you play with textures, because unlike meat, vegetables have a lot of different colors and textures that you can enjoy playing with. And often kids love that.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chrissy is with us in Madison. Chrissy, hi.
Hi. I want to thank you so much for this, because it's my birthday today and I'm a vegetarian. So a lot of times on the Fridays, this doesn't really set in with me, and this is absolutely perfect. So I appreciate that. I have vegetarian kids as well, and the bowls actually work amazing. So they love when I make stuffed peppers or squash bowls with different vegetables in them, and it just works out great. So I'm really looking forward to reading your book. Thank you.
Chrissy, happy birthday. I don't want to let you go quite yet. Talk about, so when you say squash bowl, you got like what, two halves of an acorn squash, and they're the actual bowls and the squash and other stuff, you serve it up in there?
Oh, yes. And so my favorite is the acorn squash, but we grow our own squash as well. So we grow acorn and then spaghetti squash, which is a fabulous, fabulous, because it gives you so much food in just one little squash. And you can make spaghetti or lasagna or whatever out of it. And then the peppers, we just kind of carve out and we put in rice. And then also like other peppers or tomatoes and that sort of thing in it with some spices. And the kids absolutely love it.
Chrissy, thanks so much for sharing that. And Nick, one of my favorite things about Wisconsin in the fall and winter months is all the squash. Do you have favorite ways to work with winter squash?
Oh, absolutely. Just like Chrissy said, one of my favorite winter squashes is the acorn squash, because I feel unlike pumpkins, the flavor is much stronger and is not as sweet. So what I love to do with acorn squashes, toss it with a little bit of olive oil and salt after slicing it, stick it in the oven, roast it, and then I add a little bit of sauteed kale, and I cook up some onions with a little bit of paprika and salt and pepper and a little bit of vinegar. Put it all together, and so it's sweet, salty, just plays so well. It's one of my favorite dishes to make.
And thanks again for that call, Chrissy. Nick, I've got a squash at home. It's like acorn, but that mottled color. I never remember what they're called. It is destined to become soup over the weekend. Are you a big fan of turning your vegetables into various kinds of soups?
Oh my gosh, that is such a game changer, because something really simple can then become so fancy. And what I love to do, and I'm going to recommend you to try this out too. When you're roasting your squash, add a little bit of baking soda along with the salt. It will make the flavors even stronger and more pronounced. And then flavor it with whatever you want. I usually add something crunchy. If I'm feeling lazy, I'll grab the bag of, what are those French crispy fried onions. Sprinkle a little bit of that on top and call it a day.
Fantastic. Let's go back to our callers now. Marvin is with us in Menominee. Marvin, hi.
Hey, hello. Thank you for taking my call. And it's an excellent topic today. 3 years of cooking commercially and at home, I've found that the absolute best way to ensure your vegetables become flavorful, people like them, etc., and they look good, is to roast them. Roasting them, just there's so many things to that product, whether no matter what vegetable it is, onions, carrots, of course, potatoes, but peppers, Brussels sprouts. Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, you get some color to them. You can season them the way you like them. They look so much better than an insipid pile of vegetables that's been steamed or boiled, you know, and dropped on a plate.
Marvin, thanks a lot for that call. I'm on your side. And Nick, I got to say, my personal veggie cooking game went way up when I discovered too late in life the magic of roasting vegetables. It really brings out so much flavor.
It absolutely does. Roasting is probably one of the best techniques in cooking.
Thanks a lot for that call, Marvin. Are there surprising vegetables, Nick, that people might not think of for putting in the oven that work surprisingly well?
Oh, that's a good question. So, I think any vegetable that's really rich in sugar benefits from roasting. Mm-hmm. But also, one of the vegetables that I really don't cook with a lot in the oven are cabbages. Now, if you cut cabbage into wedges or even just into chunks, toss them with a little bit of olive oil, season them the way you normally would, put them in the oven and roast them at about 400 to 425 Fahrenheit. The leaves turn really delicious. They almost start to melt away and they become even more sweeter. That's why I think roasting is just one of the most transformative techniques in cooking.
Thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Nick Sharma on this edition of Food Friday. His new book is Veg Table: Recipes, Techniques, and Plant Science for Big-Flavored, Vegetable-Focused Meals. Let's check out another recipe you sent along. You've got a potato dish here for us. Bombay potato croquettes. So this is, you write, your hometown way back when. Talk about these croquettes.
Okay, so these croquettes are really simple to make. And, you know, if you have store-bought mashed potatoes, they'll work here well too. Now, this recipe is actually based, so in India, we love potatoes a lot. And usually they're fried in some kind of form. And frying, I think, always makes things easier. So this dish is based on that. The croquettes are mashed, fried, and then served with a spiced tomato chutney. They're perfect as little bites for any party, but also on the weekend. This is something I'll make and snack for movie night. It is so, so good.
Excellent. And when you're putting together a meal, you're not vegan, not the recipes in the book aren't all necessarily vegan. How do you put together, you know, different veggies? How do you set that whole menu with some of the veggie concepts in your book?
So if I'm setting a menu up for guests with people, the one thing that I think about is how heavy are the vegetables? So veggies that are usually starchy tend to be much more filling, much more satisfying. So potatoes, squashes, winter squashes, they can be quite heavy. Sweet potatoes, that's another one of my favorite vegetables. So I tend to, if that's going to be the entree, then my sides and accompaniments and even my starters tend to be much smaller. So play with kind of how heavy a vegetable might feel and then kind of space your menu out. Now, if I were doing something like a main course that is lighter, but it's a salad, then I'll throw in things that are a little heavier. And sometimes I'll play with croutons. So I won't add bread as croutons. I'll roast sweet potatoes in little dice-shaped forms, roast them, use them as croutons in a salad. So there are a lot of fun things that you can do with a salad when preparing a menu with vegetables. Just play with the textures and see how filling they might feel.
Oh, that salad reminds me, by the way, another recipe you highlighted for us, the broccoli za'atar salad. So this is this spice, often in a blend format, the za'atar. Tell us a little bit about this broccoli salad with the za'atar.
So this is a fresh broccoli salad. The broccoli is kind of, so it's crunchy. It's got all its flavor inside. And then it's tossed with za'atar, which is a Middle Eastern spice blend and contains sesame seeds and oregano usually, or the herb za'atar, which is less frequently found in America. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that goes in here is date syrup. If you don't have date syrup, you can use molasses. A little bit of pomegranate molasses are also in this. So it's sweet, tangy, and very earthy, and really wonderful during winter. And what I've also done in this salad, I've put dried cranberries, and you can also use dried sweetened tart cherries just for a little bit of sweet acidity. So it's fruity, it's got the fresh taste of broccoli, and it's a light broccoli salad.
In just our last minute or so, Nick, you mentioned those sweet potatoes. That's another one I love, oven roasting. Leave us with some thoughts on what to do with our sweet potatoes this winter.
Sweet potatoes. So with sweet potatoes, obviously roast them, because to me, that's the best technique available to get their flavors out. Makes the texture much better. The other things that I like to do with sweet potatoes, I mentioned earlier, use them as croutons in your salad. Use them in place of chicken if you're making kung pao. It works really well, and there's a recipe for that in the cookbook. Another dish that you can make with sweet potatoes is, I like to make a sweet potato puree and then add a little bit of garlic, a little bit of olive oil. You can add butter if you like butter. It's just a vegetable that gives so much in different ways and different textures.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Nick Sharma, molecular biologist, writer, photographer, and chef. We talked to him today about his new cookbook. It's called Vegetable Recipes, Techniques, and Plant Science for Big-Flavored, Vegetable-Focused Meals. We're going to have our website was slowing down a little bit. We're going to have a few of the recipes we talked with Nick about over at WPR.org/Food Friday. And I think I found, I pulled up some pictures. Carnival squash is that one that's sitting on a counter waiting to become soup this weekend. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. As the use of cold hard cash has declined in the U.S. over the years, some businesses have gone cashless, only accepting credit cards or other forms of digital payment. A new bill in the Wisconsin legislature wants to change that and require businesses to accept cash as a form of payment on most transactions under $2,000. Republican Representative Michael Schrah of Oshkosh is the lead author of the bill and presented it this week to an assembly committee.
The statement, "This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private," is found on every single piece of paper currency in circulation, and yet there is no federal requirement to accept that currency during a transaction. Over the last couple of years, numerous businesses have made the change to not accept cash payments. While it is convenient to just use your card and be done with the transaction in seconds, this mandate can be overly burdensome to pay for necessities. It leaves out individuals who are unwilling or unable to use cashless payments.
Similar laws have passed in other states and in some cases cities around the country. Today we're finding out more about that bill and how cash and cashless transactions affect different businesses and consumers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want businesses in Wisconsin to be required to accept cash? Why or why not? And what is your preference? Do you try to use cash whenever possible? Do you try to use something other than cash whenever possible? If you're a business owner yourself, we'd love to hear from you about the best way to get paid. Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Anya Van Wagtendonk is a Capitol reporter for WPR. I talked to her earlier today. Anya, give us the outlines. What would this bill do if ultimately passed?
Basically, no retail establishment could refuse to accept cash for purchases under $2,000. So you've probably been to like a new coffee shop that only takes cards or Apple Pay or whatever. So those types of cashless establishments would be more or less outlawed, and businesses would be subject to fines up to $5,000 if they refuse to take cash.
What is the argument behind the bill from the sponsors of the legislation?
Yeah, there are a few different arguments for these types of proposals, but Representative Schraw's main explanation was that it takes away consumer choice. So he thinks that customers should get to decide how they pay for goods and services. He also thinks that moving away from cash is sort of like a gimme to credit card companies. And so there's also a bit of an argument for being aware of personal finances, that kind of forcing that move to rely on things like credit cards could encourage more irresponsible spending behavior. There's also an argument that these types of requirements, or going cashless rather, disenfranchises particular groups who don't have access to banks or credit cards. So that could be people who don't use those institutions for religious or ideological reasons, but also lower income people are just less likely to have access to banks. Some people can't afford to maintain a bank account. And so some people say that, you know, cashless really kind of disenfranchises those people from being able to access those types of businesses.
There was an assembly committee hearing. Did we hear any kind of pushback there? If so, what were the counter arguments?
Yeah, it's interesting. So there's, you know, kind of a pro-business argument on both sides of this issue. There are several small business owners on that committee. And so some of them were focused on sort of the rights of business owners to make choices about how to conduct their own businesses. And so, you know, some small businesses especially say that going to only card or only mobile payments, it can cut down on labor costs or time spent at the counter, sort of just generally streamline the retail process. And so some businesses prefer that. And so some lawmakers say business owners should have the right to decide how to set up their own businesses.
The lead sponsor is a Republican. Are we seeing any kind of bipartisan support for this anti-cashless bill?
Yeah, two Milwaukee Democrats are signed on. I haven't spoken to them directly, but I think that shows sort of the interesting unification that can happen on issues like this. Milwaukee, up until recently, actually had a fairly high rate of unbanked people. And so I could see that being an issue that could, you know, disproportionately affect some lower income residents of Milwaukee, sort of compared to the rest of the state. And also, when you look at other places that have passed these kinds of bills, notably that's New York, Washington, D.C., and Philly. So those are big Democratic strongholds. And so I think that gives an interesting sense, even though this is a GOP proposal, that it could, you know, get support from both parties.
A similar bill has been proposed in the past in Wisconsin, didn't end up going anywhere. It's always tough to tell at the outset whether something's going to fly through the legislature or just kind of go to a committee and then slowly disappear. Did you get any sense of momentum or timeline setting for this particular legislation?
No, you know, I don't have a sense of sort of timing or its odds. But I think, again, as we've discussed, there is this way in which disparate groups are kind of united on this issue and then also divided on the issue. So, for example, you know, groups who might support this type of bill might be advocates for lower income people who can't use banks. But then it also might be people, you know, more off the grid groups who don't use banks. Right. And so those particular groups might not always be on the same side of political issues, but they could be on this one. And then, as I mentioned, there's that kind of pro-business argument on either side, whether it's a consumer choice or a business operator choice argument, that could divide, I think, Republicans in particular. So unclear yet which of those arguments sort of wins the day and whether any one of them propels this bill to the floor. But I guess we will see in the new year.
Anya, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's WPR Capitol reporter Anya Van Wagtendonk bringing us the latest on a bill in the state legislature that would require businesses to accept cash payments. Now we're taking a step back to talk more broadly about how we use cash and the role it plays in our economy and society. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the idea of a state law requiring businesses to accept cash, and let us know your habits, if you like to use cash or you don't. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Ursula Dollinghouse joins us now, assistant professor of anthropology at Ripon College. She researches economic anthropology and the anthropology of money. Ursula, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into the topic, how did you go from anthropology into studying specifically the anthropology of money?
Oh, great question. Well, to make a long story short, my dissertation research was looking at the introduction of the euro currency back when it was a new shared currency among many member states. And so I was very interested in what that experience might be to share a common currency across different nation states. So That led me to doing research with the German Central Bank and looking specifically at the role of cash as a medium of connecting people to central banks, but also to these kinds of really unprecedented projects. So that's kind of how I got started. But there's a long history of research on money and value in anthropology, often in non-Western societies, but also more recently in, really all over the globe. So there's a lot of insights that one can gain cross-culturally on the use of money and cash, particularly.
Hey, now there's talk sometimes that we're going to end up, people are using cash less. We're going to end up as a cashless society. You've written in the past that, well, first of all, you don't see this being very likely. You see cash very likely to stick around. Why is that?
So I think there are two main reasons I would mention now. One is the experiential use of cash, its materiality, its qualities and affordances, to use a design term, in terms of, what having a physical token, if you will, that can be used, it's issued by a central authority, but yet it can be used outside of the purview of that central authority. And that's very unique to cash as legal tender. Obviously, I'm recognizing the caveats underlying that in terms of trusting monetary authorities, having a stable economy. But that sort of brings me into the second reason, and that is that cash is actually the only form of public money. People may not realize that, all electronic or digital money is essentially private money. And only cash is public money issued by the state or, issued by central banks. And so there's a public dimension to that medium that's quite important. And so currently, central banks globally are committed to maintaining cash as a complementary form of payment to digital. There are more recently explorations into introducing a digital version of fiat. So that's a very interesting topic users can be aware of, or listeners can be aware of. In Europe, they're actually going forward with a project to experiment with this. In the US, the Fed has basically sort of said it doesn't see a reason to introduce it anytime soon. That can always change. But in short, cash is really central to connecting us to not only the state and central authorities, but its independence of that and how it's used also for non-monetary purposes, means that it connects us deeply to others through social relationships, ritual practices, many other use cases for physical cash. So I think those are some of the key reasons I think it's around to stay, at least for some time.
We're talking to Ripon College anthropology professor Ursula Dollinghouse about cash and cashless transactions as a new bill in the state legislature aims to require businesses to accept cash payments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you started using cash less often over time? Are you someone who doesn't carry cash at all, pays everything with credit card or one of the many new digital payment apps? Or does cash rule everything around you? Do you think businesses should be required to accept cash? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ursula Dollinghouse, assistant professor of anthropology at Ripon College, who researches economic anthropology and the anthropology of money. She's with us today to talk about how businesses and consumers use cash, as lawmakers are proposing a bill that would require businesses in Wisconsin to accept cash for transactions, as some businesses don't right now. You could join in at 800-642-1234. As a consumer, do you prefer being able to pay in cash, or do you have money on you as little as possible? If you're on the business side of things, what are you seeing? And have you encountered cashless businesses much lately? Just a block apart were a couple bars. One only took money, One didn't take money at all. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Bruce is with us in Waterford. Bruce, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, your question that you keep asking is, should businesses be required to accept cash? And I don't feel like businesses should be required to accept cash. I like cash and enjoy using it, but I can always take my business elsewhere. In most cases, I think it would be foolish for a business not to accept cash. Some examples might be, you know, some kind of business, a hot dog stand or something that might be prone to being robbed. They might want to not have cash on hand, so that's not an issue. But, you know, for most of your, like, stores, I don't think that not taking cash would be a smart move. I mean, I don't know that I know anything about the subject, really, but that's just my first take on it.
Bruce, thanks a lot for sharing your take on that. And Ursley brings up a couple of interesting points. First of all, it sounds like Bruce is cool with using cash, doesn't necessarily like the idea of requiring businesses to take cash. What are your thoughts on this state legislation we were talking about? Should we mandate accepting cash?
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting question. I mean, I definitely empathize with the hot dog stand owner who might, you know, be constrained in terms of what payment options they could accept. So I think, you know, any legislation should, you know, make some accommodations for situations where it's simply impossible. It sounds like from the language on the bill that there would be some exceptions there. It's not really fleshed out in the bill. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I think that having a general mandate could be important because what people may not realize is that in order to keep the cash system sustainable, it also has to be used. And so currently, you know, cash is heavily subsidized by the state, if you will. It also settles at face value without fees associated with it, at least for the consumer. But all forms of payment cost money, of course. And so I think having a mandate that allows people who really don't have an option other than cash to be able to access essential goods and be participants in collective life is really essential. But of course, there are always situations where someone may be more limited in terms of cash that they can accept. And of course, safety issues are certainly one of the reasons why businesses and organizations have moved away from cash. But I would also say that there are other types of risks associated with digital payments. So it might be worth sort of thinking about the pros and cons of all of the different options out there.
Bruce, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Irene joins us now in Phillips. Irene, hi.
Hi there. I have just a comment to make. My hair salon here in Phillips requests cash only because they would pay a fee. They would have to pay a fee for people using credit cards. And I can understand that completely. So I go to the bank before I visit the hairstyling salon. Thank you.
Irene, thanks a lot for sharing that. And I deal with businesses sometimes, the stores, Ursula, that take cash only for that reason, or restaurants that'll have that upcharge if you pay with credit. So do you get a sense that there are a lot of businesses just for sheer economic reasons might make the same decision as her salon does?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I was just part of an international conference on the future of cash where this topic came up as well, that internationally, more businesses are offering, you know, an option to pay in cash that is, you know, a way to avoid the surcharge fees associated with credit card payments, but giving people really an incentive to use cash instead of digital in that case. And, you know, you see it around where I live too, in terms of there's a gas station that offers a 5% discount, I believe, if you pay in cash, because the surcharge fees and interchange fees associated with credit card payments are quite costly. There's been some debate about that recently as well. And so it sort of highlights the way in which cash actually is the only form of money not controlled by a private profit-driven entity. So we're kind of seeing the tension there around different channels of value and making payments and, you know, the costs associated with that. But I do believe that we're seeing more instances where businesses and entities are wanting to accept cash payments to kind of mitigate those fees.
Talking about cash and the possibility of cashless economies with Ursula Dollinghaus from Ripon College, anthropologist who studies money. And we'll go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Bernadette is with us in Baraboo. Bernadette, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your story, Bernadette?
Yeah, I just, my husband and I own self-storage business and in Lake Delton. And one of the things that we've run across through is the cash payments. And we do almost everything electronically. So we don't often meet with people at the facility. We do everything via email. And so what we've run into is there are people that need to pay with cash. And we understand that and try to be as accommodating as we can. But we don't want to meet everybody every time. Like, you have hundreds of renters. You don't want to go have to arrange to meet with them. So one option we have found that we recommend is cashier's checks, where people can go to Walmart or Quick Trip for a very low fee and, you know, turn their cash into a cashier's check or money order and then pay with that. And that's a little safer. And then they could drop that in our Dropbox, because we don't want to have cash in our Dropbox.
Fair enough. Bernadette, thanks a lot for the call. Again, Ursula, that non-cash option requires either access to a bank or you got to pay for it, whether it's the credit card fees or the fee to get that cashier's check. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a case where people do need to pay a fee in order to translate that cash into digital form in this particular business context. I guess the larger question we could ask as a society is, you know, at what point does the ability to make payments for things that we need to do in our lives have this added on cost that becomes prohibitive? And I worry in particular about not only unbanked, but underbanked people who, you know, are then sort of forced to pay more to use cash than, you know, others who have multiple different options for payment. So, you know, again, in particular situations, it's very understandable that, as I said, there's a cost to all payments, including cash. The question is, who's bearing that cost? And to what extent is, you know, payments more broadly a public good that should have some oversight in terms of, you know, what's acceptable, what's feasible for people to manage their lives?
Thanks again for that call. We just have a few moments left. Ursula, you were just at a big international conference. What are you watching for next in the story of money and cashless money?
So what I'm very curious about is, as I mentioned earlier, the European Central Bank is rolling out an experiment with digital fiat. And what's interesting about that is that, again, there's a commitment to maintaining a complementarity between physical cash and a digital version of it. However, the digital version has some other aspects to it that people should think about, namely that one can't be completely anonymous with a digital form of fiat, and that there might be limitations on how much one could hold in a digital fiat. And, you know, it would also be intermediated by commercial banks and other financial institutions. So what you're kind of seeing is, you know, to what extent can a complementarity be maintained between physical cash and a digital form of state-issued money? You know, the details of this are far off on the horizon, but I think they will be interesting to follow in the European case to see, like, what are the pragmatics of that scenario look like, and, you know, what new kind of considerations will there be for all of us globally.
That's Ursula Dollinghaus from Ripon College talking about money.